Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game. I am Kevin Day and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire, and we are both sulking a little bit because we had a five-star review this week for Producer Guy.
We did indeed.
Yeah, apparently he does a very good job and is extremely prudent with his money. I'll say he is. But it's an outrage, Kieran, isn't it? It's just shocking. You asking for five-star reviews at the end of the pod and people are going, the producer's great. I think I love the values.
Well, he's very good at telling us off when we use the wrong microphone and things of that nature. So perhaps the listeners appreciate that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, he won't be telling us off today after. He says, yeah, well done for mentioning the five-star review. Yeah, great. we're recording this on a Sunday morning, as I think people know, to go out on Monday. But sounds to me, Kieran, by the sound of that chuckle, that you might have one of your special water hangovers after last night.
Yes. It was a case of get up early this morning. Hello, trees. Hello, sky. Hello, sun. I was even more irritatingly cheerful than normal.
I was particularly pleased with the Newcastle goalkeeper last night, who seemed totally baffled by the idea that his goal had a post on either side.
Yes.
Because he stood there for the first two goals thinking, I've got this side covered. They'll have to do something special. Oh, my God. This team are working on levels I can't begin to comprehend. Newcastle are in trouble, aren't they, Kieran? I think they were poor.
This is not a football discussion show, as we both know. But I've got lots of friends in Newcastle, and I do feel for them because it is a great city, and it's a proper cathedral of a football ground as well. And for anybody that has not been there, the big market on a Saturday night is the eighth wonder of the world, in my opinion.
Yeah, for those of you who are around the world, that's big with two G's. Kieran's not just going, oh, that's a big market, isn't it? I believe their expected goals last night was one of the lowest ever in the Premier League, which is in sharp contrast to yours.
But yes.
It's unfortunately, Kieran, as you say, this is not a football discussion pod because the guy really does get cross if we start talking about actual football. It's questions day and we have some doozies. So there's time for only one news story, Kieran. So I'm going to ask you a question. Who are Team Viewer and why have they just smashed the Premier League's record shirt sponsor deal?
Team Viewer are a German software company, and they have signed a deal with Manchester United, presumably to increase their profile. So this replaces the Chevrolet deal. And the Chevrolet deal wasn't particularly successful for Chevrolet. It was certainly successful for Manchester United. Chevrolet sold 16 cars in the UK, which is indicative of perhaps the strategy is not quite right here. Manchester United will, of course, claim that Chevrolet are a global brand. This German company, it's less money for the front of shirt sponsorship than the existing deal with Chevrolet. But Chevrolet were also Manchester United's official car sponsor, which I believe they supplied the club with 16 cars.
The 16 they bought, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, got you.
It's still a good deal by the rest of the Premier League standards. It's not an increase as far as the long-term deal that Chevrolet had. But it is indicative that Manchester United are still a global brand. It was interesting looking at the share price of both of the parties after the deal was announced. Manchester United's went up slightly. The German software company's share price fell by nearly 18%.
Oh.
Which would suggest that the markets think that Team Viewers have lost their minds.
That's interesting. So, you know, we spoke at length on our last news pod, Kieran, about Avram Glazer selling a lot of shares. This won't be linked. Him selling those shares and the announcement of a new sponsorship deal won't be linked in any sort of way. Well, there's no kind of Midsummer Murders skullduggery going on here?
One would hope not. I mean, I'm sure he was aware of the deal. Manchester United are not getting a lot more money, so therefore, when you're valuing a business, you look at normally the future cash flows generated by the business. So Manchester United are broadly on a similar level to where we are at present in terms of commercial sponsorship. The reason why the stock markets have liked them over the course of the next over the last 12 months is they perceive that the broadcasting money is going to go up because Manchester United and Liverpool will get their way in some way, shape or form in terms of taking more control over the TV monies.
Yeah, and it occurs to me producer guy might not get so many five-star reviews if people knew that he willy-nilly put things in the questions like smashing the Premier League's record shirt sponsor deal when it's not quite true. Now, Man United are also looking for a new sponsor for the training ground and the training kit. Is that because no one company could possibly afford to sponsor everything?
No, I think Manchester United are very smart in that they take a bite-size chunk approach to their sponsorship arrangements, and rather than having one sponsor for everything, so there would be relatively few companies who would be able to afford to do that. The fact that they've got separate sponsors for their training kit as opposed to the first team kit, I think is just indicative of a club that has a global fan base and can shift units of a variety of things, and they've done their sums, and they felt that by having I think it's Aon, the American company who used to sponsor the front of shirt deals, and have a look at Aon and Scandal, Google that if you're interested in their financial history. Then it's simply more lucrative, and you've got to give them credit for that. In exactly the same way as they will have a mobile phone sponsor in Spain, in Thailand, in Indonesia, rather than having a global one, they've worked out that it's more beneficial financially to have a number of local deals than have a global ones for particular products.
I wasn't planning to Google Aon and Scandal, but I've got a spare half hour this afternoon. I might fit that in between my nap and tea. Questions, Kieran. We have some good questions this week, as ever. And the first one comes from David McCutcheon. And David McCutcheon starts with a thank you, Kieran, for all the shows. And he says, at the start of the pandemic, he started to walk to lose weight, and his son recommended he listen to us as he walked. And David says he's now running 5 kilometres to and from work and has lost 3 stones. David, congratulations. That is brilliant.
Superb.
You can't shake us off by running. We're in your ear. You can't get away from the voices in the head like that. David's question is pertinent, given that today we're seeing the opposite of a six-pointer Old Firm game. And David says, with the gap between Rangers and Celtic having closed so dramatically recently, many Celtic fans are saying that Dermot Desmond should be thanked for all the money he's put in recently. However, says David, as said, the club have been making great profits each year in the absence of Rangers. I would say he's taken more out of the club than he ever put in. Am I right?
No, Dermot Desmond hasn't really put anything in since around about 2005. He certainly stabilised the club when he first became involved with Celtic, and that allowed the club to challenge Rangers. You know, Rangers were on a roll under David Murray, and that sort of brought Scottish football more into a position of equilibrium. But there's been no formal investment for many years when £14 million was put in. At the same time, there's no evidence of money going out of the club. I mean, they do pay dividends on some shares, but they're not significant sums of money. What Celtic have tended to do when they have made profits is to reinvest the money into the squad and into the infrastructure. Now, it could be argued that perhaps if he had been more benevolent, the gap which Rangers have been able to reduce in recent years would have been so big that it would have made it far more of a challenge. And looking at Rangers, something actually came through into my inbox about 20 minutes before we recorded the show, and Rangers have just issued another £3 million worth of shares. So their investors are continuing to put money into the club. The reason for that is that Rangers have been losing money. Rangers' objective is to try to catch up with Celtic and then move on to a sustainable basis, but they're not quite there yet.
Yeah, My sole interest in Rangers at the moment is the fact that out of the blue on various Scottish football phone-ins, Rangers representatives have suddenly started saying Rangers are a bigger club than Crystal Palace, you know. It's like, oh, really? Oh, okay, why have you suddenly started saying that, I wonder? Even I could put two and two together on that one. It's interesting, David's question, though, because the way fans perceive a certain thing is often very different to the way you actually describe it. Because, you know, my Scottish family are all big Celtic fans, and I think they would have agreed with David McCutcheon that, you know, Dermot Desmond has been pumping loads of money in and taking loads of money out. And yet, as you say, it's not exactly like that, is it?
No. But that's why I'm the world's dullest man. I just look at numbers.
Yes, says the man who had to flee Moscow because the Russian mafia were on his tail.
Else's tail that was an issue.
That's my fault. I firmly led myself down that cul-de-sac, didn't I? We have a Scottish football special coming up in a couple of weeks' time with Neil Doncaster, who's a Scottish football supremo. He doesn't like me saying that, but I don't often get to use the word supremo. So any questions for Neil, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. Simon Vickers has a much shorter question, and I'm not entirely sure we can answer it, which is a shame, because I think most Premier League fans would love to know the answer to this. It's Simon Vickers says, when fans are allowed back for the last two Premier League games of the season, please God, I added that, how will clubs decide which season ticket holders to let in? It's a good question, Kieran, but it's probably got 10 different answers, isn't it?
Yes. And I don't think, you know, you and I are about as qualified as Simon is in terms of the answer. But what I suspect will happen is that initially clubs will say those fans who perhaps have agreed to roll over their season tickets the next season, they'll have first dibs. Because they've already put money into the club as far as this season is concerned. So that could be one model. The other model will be that all I can say with what's happened at Brighton is we've kept 25% of our season ticket money in the club with a view that if matches did return, that would be allocated against tickets, because I think they felt that, you know, if we were lucky, we might get four or five matches taking place. And if you've got money in a system such as that, it will then go to a lottery. And certainly, you know, I think most clubs are trying to ensure that the regular fans are not disadvantaged. I think what would be totally wrong would be tickets allocated on the basis of who's bought the most expensive season tickets. So, yeah, that would go against completely against the grain of a way a football club should be run.
Well, I think it's slightly difficult for Premier League because it's an odd number. If everybody was allowed back in, that would be easy to deal with. If it's only 1,000, that would probably be easy to deal with. But at Selhurst Park, for example, it's going to be 6,500. So there's going to be a kind of grey area, because I think a lot of clubs, Palace included, will probably do it on a points basis. So essentially the loyalist fans over the last two, the ones that have been to away games and bought their season tickets early will get in. But then there's probably 4,000 of them. So you've got 2,500 seats that you're trying to allocate between probably 15,000 people. And that's where it's going to get difficult. The first allocation will probably be quite easy for clubs the size of Palace and Brighton. But, you know, then it will get difficult. And, of course, everyone wants to go to this game. Back in December when some fans were allowed back in, people were still a bit nervous. But everyone would want to go to those two last games of the season, wouldn't they?
Yes. Yeah. I think it'll be... It'll be a quasi-national celebration of a return to some form of normal life, although clearly what's happening on the continent is quite sobering stuff.
It is, yes, of course, but we'll learn that's not a vaccination pod either, is it, Kieran? So let's not get into that. But I suspect the atmosphere at the last Newcastle home game against Sheffield United could be a bit lively, but there you are. Our next question comes from Dhruv Agarg, and I really do hope I've pronounced both of those names correctly, Dhruv. Apologies if I haven't. I did try. I occasionally Google things like, how do you pronounce, but Google just said refer it to somebody else, basically, with Dhruv Agarg. Dhruv says, I've had this question since the whole Project Big Picture proposals were announced, including the proposals to allow clubs to sell their own overseas rights for certain games. Theoretically, could a state-owned club like Manchester City sell the rights to those matches in their own domestic market for any value they deem fit? Or would they be subject to the market value assessment that is done for sponsorship deals, for example?
I think it almost certainly that we would have the equivalent of the fair value assessment. This is to stop related parties or quasi-related parties to the football club putting in inflated figures. There will certainly be a push from other clubs in the Premier League for that. And given that you need 14 votes, so ultimately it would be a decision that would have to be voted on by the clubs in the Premier League. I think they will almost certainly say, because they will be scared of Manchester City all of a sudden selling the Abu Dhabi rights for £700 million a year or something crazy, to try to maintain what we have at present in terms of front of shirt sponsorship, stadium sponsorship deals and things of that nature.
Could you clarify something for me, Kieran, basically? Don't worry, it's about football, not about your personal life. But we quite often get taken to task by Man City fans who will tell us that technically Manchester City aren't a state-owned club. What is their status? Would you say they're a state-owned club, or they're owned by a company that is owned by a state?
They are owned by an overseas company, ultimately. I mean, there is City Football Group, and then there is Manchester City. City Football Group owned Manchester City. We'll be coming to that a little bit later. Mm. Then you've got to look at the controlling interests in respect of City Football Group, and that is the Abu Dhabi authorities. So indirectly, yes, I think people are being a little bit pedantic. Ultimately, Sheikh Mansour is the owner, is the controller of the club in terms of the degree of investment into Manchester City.
Okay, City fans, tweet him, not me, Alex. Alex Hall, and again, this is a related to City Group, but in a good way, I think. Alex Hall says multi-club ownerships like the City Football Group have been mentioned many times on the pod recently, many times, along with the Bristol, Barcelona and Olympiacos model, which involves multiple sports. That probably should have been the Barcelona, Olympiacos and Bristol model, to be fair. As Kieran has described, the benefits of such a setup, sharing and shifting costs can be a massive advantage, for example. Why are there not more setups like this? Is there a massive disadvantage that I'm missing?
There is a massive thing which Alex perhaps should take into consideration. If you take a look at all of the football clubs which are owned by the City Football Group, collectively, they cost the owners £999 million to buy.
Right.
So unless you've got a huge amount of money sloshing round, then it becomes a very expensive business. So, City Football Group, they have bought New York City, Melbourne City, the clubs in Mumbai and China and Japan and France, Belgium and so on. Every time they do that, that means more money has to be found in order to make those purchases. Then you've got the operational losses. So Manchester City Football Club in 2019 made a profit of £10 million. That's great. Yeah, that's fine. Alex is saying, there is the opportunity, and I'm not saying that this is the case with Manchester City. There is the opportunity to allocate costs to some of those other clubs in an environment where financial fair play doesn't apply. The City Football Group lost £82 million in 2019. So somebody has got to fund those losses. So if your objective is to make money out of a football club, then why go to all this trouble? Because all you do is you might satisfy financial fair play in one country, but overall it's costing you a fortune to do so elsewhere around the world. If your objectives are broader than monetary, which I think it is fair to say that is the case with the City Football Group, then those losses are just seen as an occupational hazard.
And there's probably quite a big distinction, isn't there, Kieran, between the City Football Group and someone like Bristol, who owns a rugby club as well, or Barcelona, who own a handball club as well, isn't there?
I mean, Manchester City are clearly linked to the owners in terms of profile and things of this nature. Barcelona are a sporting entity and is a members-only club. Bristol City is the personal fiefdom of the owner, who's been incredibly generous to the city of Bristol, and he's a Bristol fan. And a sports fan, and he's not necessarily keener on football than rugby. He just wants to see success in the city.
Now, Kieran, I've got a pronunciation dilemma with this next one, because it's L-O-U-I-S, which I would pronounce Louis, but I've got a mate who spells his first name L-O-U-I-S who pronounces it Louis. I've got another one who pronounces it Lewis, despite the fact we tell him it should be L-E-W-I-S in that case. He says he can pronounce his name whatever way he wants, which is a fair argument. So I don't know, Louis or Lewis. Let's go Louis. Louis Wishlade says, do you know why Fulham didn't sell the players they bought for very high fees and wages in 2018-19 and instead chose to loan some of them out in the 19-20 championship season that followed? Is it because they couldn't sell those players for a loss without breaching financial fair play rules? And it's a really interesting question from Louis, because Fulham have got a lot of loan players this season as well, and then most of them are playing, aren't they? Is that sensible?
It's yes and no when it comes to the loan market. Fulham spent £118 million on player signings in the year that they were promoted in 2018-19. And clearly that didn't work to the extent that they wished, and they were subsequently relegated. That meant that they had a lot of players on big, big contracts. And the trouble is, if you've got a player who's on 50, 60 grand a week, there's a limited number of clubs who are willing to sign him, especially if he's not proven to be particularly successful in the Premier League the previous season. So when it came to the issue of what were they going to do for 2019-20, the players would have been available, but nobody was willing to pay the wages. So therefore, what Fulham did, they made commercial decision that it's better to get a player somewhere else and you get the other club paying half the wages and paying a small loan fee than it is to have him sitting around the training ground or in a bad mood. You don't want to end up with the position of Sunderland with Jack Rodwell or Wolves with, I've forgotten his name, but you know, the players who are on huge contracts, who are unhappy, who for whatever reason have fallen out of favour. So the rationale behind using the loan markets is that it reduces the costs of the club in terms of having to pay his full wages. In terms of losses for financial fair play purposes, that could be a further issue, because if you've signed a player for £30 million on a four-year contract, at the end of that first year, after taking away amortisation, his value is £22.5 million. And if you can't get him for if you can't sell him for £22.5 million, then you're going to sell him at a loss. That could mean that you're in breach of FFP. So you're actually better off keeping him on the books for another 12 months, putting him out on loan somewhere, getting a wee bit of money back, and then at the end of year two, his value in the books is £15 million. And from an FFP purpose, if you then sell him at the end of year two, there's a smaller loss going through.
Mm. It's not like you to forget a name. Did you have a second pint of water last night, Kieran, to celebrate?
Well, it's Jamie O'Hara. I've just remembered.
Oh, that's a shame, because I was gonna get Ali to dub it and get Guy to put it in. See if anybody noticed.
Well, we still can.
Kieran, Jack Rodwell, Jamie O'Hara. and my wife doesn't. Thank God she doesn't listen to this pod. She does, Guy. She does. It was probably her that gave Guy the 5-star review. Dionysios Palikis has been in touch, and Dionysios—it's a great name, isn't it? It's Dionysios has a question on the Qatar World Cup. Join the club. We all have many questions on the Qatar World Cup. If Dionysios says hypothetically, a National Football Association decided to boycott the 2022 tournament. And as Dionysios points out, there is no shortage of potential reasons for such a boycott, from the treatment of LGBTQ plus people to the conditions faced by migrant workers. Would that National Football Association face any financial repercussions? And if enough countries boycotted, would it affect the tournament's profitability? Sadly, Dionysios, that probably will remain a hypothetical question, but it's a very valid one, isn't it?
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yeah, I mean, you and I are both old enough to remember the Olympics in Moscow in 1980, I think it was, and then the subsequent Olympics in 1984, which the first of which were boycotted by the West due to Russia invading somewhere.
Afghanistan
at the time.
It was Afghanistan, yeah.
It was Afghanistan, yeah. We'll
get Ali to dub that in as well if you want.
As far as the authorities are concerned, I think we need to separate it into two entities. First of all, there's FIFA itself. FIFA make their money from the broadcast deals that they have signed with global broadcasters. Well, if there's a World Cup taking place with the 32 teams or however many it is in next year's tournament, they will say, we've delivered, so therefore you're getting no money back. When it comes to ticket sales, those tickets will be sold well in advance. And FIFA will, to a certain extent, be guaranteed that revenue coming in. Then there's the commercial deals. The commercial deals for the World Cup have already been signed off with FIFA's global partners. So FIFA will not be worse off, regardless of any form of boycott. We then come to the Qatari World Cup Committee, effectively the local organisation. The World Cup's going to lose money for Qatar because the setup costs are so high. I mean, I've been to Qatar. I've seen some of the stadiums. I've done a little bit of teaching there with regards to football issues. And it's not expected to be profitable in the context of the overall infrastructure investment. If we take a look at Qatar, it's got a total population of 2.8 million, of whom only 300,000 are citizens. You know, Qatar's got a very big migrant population in forms of infrastructure people, professional services and things of that nature. The total capacity of the stadia in Qatar is 380,000. So if every Qatari citizen went to a match, there would still be plenty of spaces. At least two of those stadiums are going to be dismantled after the tournament. But in terms of making money, that was never an objective. The intention was to showcase Qatar as a country, as a destination for trade, tourism, and things of that nature. So it will possibly increase the losses if the big teams don't attend. Then there's going to be fewer fans from those big teams. But I think it's highly unlikely there will be a boycott. Made reference to the LGBTQ plus community. Well, it's been well known that I used to teach in Russia. Unfortunately, there the attitude towards people of different sexual persuasions is very, very hostile. It's very depressing to see the somewhat archaic mentality of not just some of the people there, but also the politicians.
I was in Qatar performing for exiles not long before the World Cup was agreed. No one was interested. It's not just the reactionary nature of some of the attitudes of the government there. It's the fact that football simply isn't a national sport and won't be afterwards. It still beggars belief that the World Cup is going there. I can't see them filling the stadia. I think if they ever have full stadia for any of the games, it will be because local school children are busting for nothing. Because my sense is, and it's obviously not helped by COVID, I don't know many football fans that are particularly interested in going there. I mean, we're only a year out from the tournament, and normally by now people would have started booking. They'd have been getting excited. You'd be seeing all sorts of WhatsApp groups. I just, it's for the once in my life, I'm not looking forward to it. It shouldn't be there. It's probably for the best that we hadn't started this pod 2 years earlier, because I think all we would have talked about would have been that World Cup. So let's move on before we fall down that trap again. Steve Cutler is a Bristol Rovers fan and reminds us that Bristol Rovers have been on a dodgy financial footing for as long as he can remember. But Steve's question is based around the relatively recent announcement from the owner that they converted club debts into shares. Now, Steve says this was hailed as an excellent idea, but as an ever-sceptical lower league football fan, I'd love to know your thoughts. And I presume Steve is talking to you, Kieran, there, not me.
Well, Bristol Rovers have been losing, you know, on average, you know, £50,000 to £60,000 a week for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. So it's further evidence that football is a tough industry. And the only way that those losses can be covered is either by selling players, but these profits are after player sales, or the alternative is for the owner to put money into the club to underwrite those losses. And you can put those those covering costs in via loans or shares. Initially, some of the investment was in the form of loans. I think realistically, the owner took the view that if you are a football club owner, your behaviour is the equivalent of being the bank of mum and dad, i.e. you give money to your kids, loan it nominally, but both parties, there's an unwritten acknowledgement that the money is never going to be repaid. Bristol Rovers would not be in a position to repay the owners the amount that has been lent historically. And therefore, what's been happening here is more of a housekeeping exercise. So it's probably a better thing than a badder thing, would be my assessment if Steve is trying to get some sort of feeling for this. Shares are what we refer to as irredeemable, and therefore there's never any obligation for shareholders to get their money back from the club. Whereas a loan, but by the nature of a loan, normally has some form of repayment date in the future. So by converting loans into shares, it at least means that either this owner this is based on zero evidence whatsoever. If I was selling a football club, I would probably convert the loans into shares just to make it appear better from the point of view of a potential new owner. Because what they don't want to do is to take over the club and still be obliged to redeem loans to the previous owner. It makes the balance sheet look better.
An ex-girlfriend called me irredeemable once. just as we were going through the process of going from girlfriend to ex-girlfriend. Probably not a good thing, is it? Simon Ordover has a question, which I think is a really interesting one, Kieran, actually. Simon says, is there a benefit to being a shareholder in the Premier League rather than a franchisee, as clubs are in the MLS, for example?
Yeah, I thought this was intriguing. I mean, one of the advantages of being a shareholder is that there is more flexibility in the sense that we have promotion and relegation to the Premier League. So therefore, if you are a shareholder of Huddersfield or Sheffield United or Brighton or Palace, and you've come from the lower tier of football, then by having an investment in the club at an earlier stage, potentially the club can be sold as a Premier League club at a higher price, and you can make an awful lot of money from that. So that would be one of the benefits of being a shareholder. In theory, your club is your fiefdom, and within reason, you're free to do with it as you wish. So if you want to put more money in the form of shares or loans, as we've seen with Roman Abramovich, as we've seen with Sheikh Mansour, as we've seen with other clubs as well, then there's nobody else that you have to ask permission from. Whereas if you were a franchisee, that would not necessarily be the case. And you might have to get the permission of the other franchisees within the MLS or the governor of the governor of the MLS, the general manager, whatever it's going to be. One the advantages of a franchise model is that if you're in a franchise, you know, whereas we as football fans and also some football club owners, our objective is to see us win matches, potentially win trophies, achieve promotion, qualification for European competitions and things of that nature. If you're a franchisee, the aim is to make money. So you know that balance, and what we've got in the Premier League at present is a mixture of some owners who view clubs as a franchise, and I would put there, and this isn't a criticism of the American model, but mainly the American owners. So FSG at Liverpool, the Glazers at Manchester United, Stan Kroenke at Arsenal and ALK at Burnley, their objective is for those clubs to make money, and therefore they make money on the back of that. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't sit easily when you've got the likes of you know, Sheikh Mansour, Roman Abramovich, who just in it for the love of winning things. You know, it is a trophy asset. In a franchise arrangement, everybody's got that same objective, and everybody's got the focus on the bottom line. So therefore, you're more likely to have things such as wage caps and things of this nature. We've just seen this week the NFL has announced their new TV distribution rights in the States, and the first implications for that. Well, okay, there'll be some tweaks to the wage cap, but still an awful lot of money is going to come through to club owners.
Sorry, Kieran, I was just putting my cup of tea down there.
I thought you'd give me an order there.
No, I put the cup of tea down harder than normal because it's colder than it was 45 minutes ago. Sam, just a little insight into the domestic life of the Price of Football production team there. It's not even the Price of Football mug, and God knows we've got enough of them to use. Sam Woodruff tells us that he's a long-time Norwich fan. In general, everybody, we'll take your word for the fact that you've been supporting your club for a long time. I'll be more surprised if I got a question saying, I've been supporting MK Don since Tuesday, and I'm beginning to regret it. But anyway, Sam's a long-time Norwich fan, and Sam is really enjoying the current performance on and off the pitch, playing attractive football, clearing our debts, and coping during the pandemic. However, says Sam, without rich owners, ours are the third poorest in the Championship, apparently, and using a sustainable model, could Norwich ever challenge at the top end of the Premier League? Well, I'll give my short answer to that, Kieran, which is no, and then happily sit back and let you contradict me.
Could they do it in the short term? Yes, they could.
Really?
We saw, I can remember Reading doing extremely well in their first season in the Premier League. Sheffield United had a good first season. So, but what tends to happen is ultimately football is a talent game, and the more you invest in talent, the greater the chances of getting positive results on the pitch. So you can have a scenario where a club punches above its weight financially and has a fantastic season. The chances of that being repeated on a regular basis are relatively remote. You know, we remember we did see Leicester City win the Premier League in 2016 on a budget which was that of a fraction of the other clubs, the other large clubs. Why did they do that? Well, they recruited N'Golo Kanté. They recruited Jamie Vardy for buttons. And for that 12 months, they were the best team in the country, and they deservedly won the Premier League. What did they immediately do? Well, that side, and Kanté left. They did very well to get to the quarterfinals of the Champions League the following season. But they then had, they sacked their manager because they were in the bottom half of the Premier League. So, on a short term basis, yes, if you've got a United dressing room, if you've got a manager who's a very good motivator of players, I think that then for a period of a couple of years, you can punch above your weight. Eventually, either the manager goes elsewhere because he's attracted or he becomes attractive to other clubs, or the players do the same.
you know, the problem is, Kieran, for Sam and other Norwich fans, is that we've got a very recent example of an attractive footballing Norwich side coming out of the Premier League and then their ownership saying no interest whatsoever in spending the money to stay there.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, certainly Norwich's model, which I would describe as an air shot, is in some ways similar to that of the Burnley owners. When Burnley were promoted to the Premier League quite a few years ago, they again made little or no investment in the squad, took the money from the Premier League and used that when they were relegated to build up a more sustainable approach. And they immediately came back up to the Premier League. So if Norwich are taking that approach, then it might work. You know, as you know, I'm a big fan of Sean Dyche and what he has achieved at Burnley with that type of strategy. And there's no reason why Norwich couldn't do the same.
Mm-hmm. Nathan Braithwaite says that Millwall recently wore Kick It Out instead of Husky Chocolate on their shirts. Is it likely that Millwall have had to refund some sponsorship money to Husky?
No. Under, I think, both the Premier League and the EFL deals, you are allowed once a season to wear a shirt which is linked to the normally a club charity. So, yeah, you know, we've seen Liverpool do that. I've seen other clubs do that. You know, Millwall use this for Kick It Out, and you've got to, you know, it's a good thing to do. So it shows, because we become so blasé. I'm so used to seeing American Express on the front of a shirt at the Amex that at the Amex Stadium that it's not going to make me like or dislike the company any more than before. So therefore, is it going to make a difference? And I used to work in the post room at American Express. It was my first ever job on £30 a week.
Wow.
Yeah, those were the days, Kevin. Those were the days. And then the following year, they gave me a pay rise because I was good with numbers and I made fewer mistakes than the other post office boys.
Living the dream. Yeah, those with there aren't. There's only a limited number of mistakes you can make, isn't there? Putting letters into pigeonholes. Oh, I guess. Yeah, it's so you say that about American Express. I've resolutely boycotted them ever since they took over as your shirt sponsor, helped by the fact that they've resolutely refused to give me a credit card in the first place for quite some years. So it's a relationship we're both quite happy with.
Yeah, also, I'm same with Virgins.
Dear. Also, I suppose as well, and it's an interesting question from Nathan, but it reflects quite well on the regular sponsor, doesn't it? Because people will go, oh, that's nice. They've given up a week's worth of sponsorship for Kick It Out. So it's not going to negatively affect the regular sponsor, is it, by doing that?
Yeah. And anything which raises the profile of charities and organisations such as Kick It Out is got to be a positive. So, you know, fair play to all involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Tony McNeary, and this is a question after your heart, Kieran. So you've been looking forward. I deliberately kept this one down the end to keep your attention. Tony McNeary says, a COVID-induced loss in revenue is never going to be helpful to any club's finances. But in Spurs' case, there seems to have been some exceptional movements in certain costs that helped to push 2019's £87 million profit into 2020's £68 million loss. Tottenham's total operating expenses increased by £83 million, and of that, £46 million was an increase in depreciation. Why would that be the case?
Well, depreciation is similar to amortization, except it applies to infrastructure assets. So in 2020, Spurs had a full season in the new stadium, and that new stadium cost well over £1 billion. So therefore, you depreciate the new stadium for the whole of the year. Whereas if we take a look at 2019, for the first probably two-thirds, three-quarters of that season, Spurs were, of course, still playing at Wembley. So therefore, they weren't depreciate. You only start to depreciate an asset when you start to generate money from it, as far as the accounts are concerned. So in 2019, Spurs depreciated the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium for 3 months of the year. And when it came to 2020, they did that for 12 months of the year, therefore increasing the depreciation cost.
Yeah, judging by the mood of Tottenham fans at the moment, Spurs may have to fork out to get rid of the manager by the look of things. Mm. James Gulk takes us from the top half of the Premier League to the lower end of non-league football. And James says, what are the reasons, benefits of certain players having dual registration in non-league? And is this only allowed at certain levels?
Yes, it is. The rationale behind dual registration is that on any one weekend, you can play for one of two clubs. Now, this tends to be for players who are on a non-contract basis, i.e. they've not signed a 12-month deal or a 10-month deal, if it was the National League, for a particular club. And the logic behind this is, you know, if you are a football player at, you know, levels 3 to 6 or whatever it's going to be, then what do you want to do each Saturday? You want to play football. Mm. Now, it could be that you've the manager at Club A says, look, mate, you know, you're not quite in my plans this weekend. And the player says, well, okay, well, I'm not getting paid by you anyway. Or at best, I'm doing is getting boot money. I'll go and play for Club B. Now, the only thing that has to be the case is that if you do have dual registration, you've got to be registered in different leagues. So you can't go and play for an opponent against your team or things of that nature. From the player's point of view, he's getting playing time. You know, if you're amateur or quasi-amateur footballer, or what do you want to do? You just want to play football. So you go and play for a different team. That means that you're getting a bit of experience. It could be that you know, the Club A is still keeping an eye on you. They've got somebody in the crowd. From the club's point of view, it keeps the players a bit happier, and also it's a, you know, ultimately a match is a form of training. So, you know, you're getting some exercise. So that's the logic behind that. But as soon as you move to a scenario where you sign a formal 12-month, you know, semi-professional or professional contract, you wouldn't be able to do that anymore.
Mm. We started, Kieran, with one big news story from the Greater Manchester area. So let's finish with another quite big news story from the Greater Manchester area, which I want to discuss because it involves one of your closest friends in football, Steve Dale.
Yes, Steve Dale tried to effectively claim the intellectual property or the trademark in respect of the crest of the club and effectively the crest of the town. The opposition club, AFC Berry, wasn't happy about that because they had a crest which was broadly similar, and there was in danger of losing the right to put that crest on their shirts, and Steve Dale lost. So, suck that one up, Stevie boy. I've got no sympathy for you whatsoever.
You remember we had this discussion in our last pod, Kieran, about the reasons why we may not be winning as many awards as we perhaps should do in the serious world of financial football podcasting. Phrases like "suck that up, Stevie boy" are not helping, Kieran. I'm gonna much as that should be the headline for this spot.
I'm sure producer guy is hot dialing the Swiss Ramble as we speak, you know, trying to renegotiate his fee.
I just really can't imagine the circumstances by which Swiss Ramble would say "suck that up, Stevie boy." But it's a sentiment I heartily endorse. And the only reason we included that story was that it had the phrase "Steve Dale lost," and it's a small victory, Kieran, in a world where football at clubs at that level are not getting many small victories. So I was very happy to end on that. If you have any questions for us about any level of football finance at all, and in particular, if you have any questions for us for that Scottish special we have coming up with Neil Doncaster, email us on questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall let Mr. 3 points, 3 goals, 3 pints of water Maguire, it's clearly still off his face, judging by his outburst there about sucking up Stevie boy, say goodbye.
Well, once again, folks, thanks for the feedback and the all the kind words that you send to us. If you are enjoying the show, if you want to go and press that that big purple icon button on the Apple Podcasts or similar with Spotify or Google Podcasts, if you could give us a review, 5 stars, please, if you're enjoying it. Even if you're not enjoying it, we'd still be happy with a 5-star review, to be perfectly true. It doesn't matter what you say. You can say, you know, when are they going to get the Swiss Ramble in for a degree of professionalism onto the show? We don't care. You know, it simply helps us in terms of negotiating with potential guests and from the business side of things, which goes way above the head of myself and Kevin. So until then, stay safe. And I'm still trying to come to terms with a match where the actual goals scored by Brighton over Albion exceeded our XG.
Yeah. Do you know what, Kieran? After 18 months of dealing with our listeners, I've got the slight suspicion that producer guy is going to get a lot more 5-star reviews now, isn't he?
Yes.
I know how this thing works. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.